Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Greetings and welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments, Pope Benedict XVI visits a Roman prison, celebrating St. Patrick's Day, and when the last Pope named Benedict wrote an encyclical about Dante. Thanks very much for joining me. Pope Benedict XVI has a special appointment this Sunday, the 18th of March. He'll be leaving the Vatican to visit Rome's Casal del Marmo Juvenile Detention Centre. This marks his first visit to a prison since becoming Pope. The Holy Father will celebrate Mass in the prison's chapel on the occasion, and afterwards will meet with the inmates and the prison staff. Susie Hodges reports.
By paying a visit to a prison in Rome this Sunday, Pope Benedict is following in the footsteps of his predecessors. Pope John XXIII, Pope Paul VI and Pope John Paul II all visited Rome's Regina Coeli prison during their papacies. In addition, Pope John Paul made an especially memorable visit to Rome's Rebibbia prison in 1983, where he met the Turkish gunman Mohammed Ali Ajka, who tried to assassinate him 2 years earlier. The two men talked alone in Ajka's prison cell, and the Pope again offered his forgiveness to his would-be killer. Ajka was serving a jail term in Rebibbia for shooting and seriously wounding the Pope during his general audience in St. Peter's Square in May 1981. Pope John Paul also visited the Casal del Marmo prison in 1980. Situated in northern Rome, this prison complex was set up around 50 years ago as a correction centre and was transformed into a closed jail in 1970. It currently houses around 70 juveniles, of whom less than a third are female. Most of the inmates are immigrants, often without papers, who come from Romania, the former Yugoslavia, or else China and South America. Currently, just over 10% of the prisoners are Italians. Chiara Maria Castrignano is a social assistant at the Casal del Marmo prison, and she told me that there's a lot of excitement among the young inmates ahead of this papal visit.
Yes, very excited. Their feeling is a deep interest for the visit of the Pope, and they are showing it by making questions to the operators. And this event represents for them not only a way to escape the daily routine, but an effective way of showing the feeling of spirituality.
In general, how would you describe conditions inside the prison?
They live a lot of activities like school, art craft and sport. They have many operators that looking for them, like educators, psychologists and social workers, and also teachers, because they do also school inside.
But how would you describe the morale of the inmates? Because it must be quite a depressing experience to be inside prison.
Yes, of course, but we try to care for them, listen to their problems and try to resolve them. And also they have a visit with the parents and telephones.
What then do tend to be the most common crimes for which the young people are detained at Casal del Marmo?
Yes, most of them are in prison for robbery or stealing or burglary. Few of them for more serious crimes like homicide.
What about drugs?
That also drugs, yes. Not most of them, but part of them.
Are there many different nationalities there?
Yes, most of them are foreign, come from foreign country, like Romania and ex-Yugoslavia. Few of them are Italian.
Well, thanks there to Chiara Maria Castrignano, a social assistant at the Casal del Marmo prison, and of course to Susie Hodges. Pope Benedict also expressed his concern for prisoners in a document released earlier in the week. You may recall it's the post-synodal exhortation on the Eucharist. I've asked Sean Patrick Lovett to read this passage for us. Let's listen.
The Church's spiritual tradition, basing itself on Christ's own words, has designated the visiting of prisoners as one of the corporal works of mercy. Prisoners have a particular need to be visited personally by the Lord in the sacrament of the Eucharist. Experiencing the closeness of the ecclesial community, sharing in the Eucharist, and receiving Holy Communion at this difficult and painful time can surely contribute to the quality of a prisoner's faith journey and to full social rehabilitation. Taking up the recommendation of the Synod, I ask dioceses to do whatever is possible to ensure that sufficient pastoral resources are invested in the spiritual care of prisoners.
And now, as announced earlier, it's time to celebrate. It's the 17th of March once again, the day the Church remembers St. Patrick. On this particular day, right across the world, Irish are celebrating. And while there may be no shamrocks in Rome, there are plenty of Irish people around. I thought it'd be a good idea to ask them to speak about the figure of this Irish apostle. How to distinguish the man from the myth grown up around him. One of those Irish people in Rome is Emma McCarthy. And a priest, she knows, who chose to focus precisely on the life and works of St. Patrick for his doctorate in systematic theology. He's Father Billy Swan.
May every hurtless blessing, every pure prayer, every ladder which reaches heaven be of help to me. Every good saint who has suffered on the face of the earth below, every pious disciple who believed in Christ, everyone meek, everyone quiet, everyone sincere, everyone unsullied, every confessor, every soldier who exists beneath the sun.
These two letters especially are one of our best kept secrets.
Entitled The Experience of God in the Life and Legend of St. Patrick, in his work Father Billy Swan has gone back to the source, two letters penned by the saint sometime in the 5th century as he looked back upon a lifetime devoted to converting the pagan hordes of Ireland to God.
The historical Patrick, or the Patrick that lived and laboured in Ireland sometime in the 5th century, was the author of two letters that we have, thankfully, from our tradition today. One is called a Confessio, which comes from the last sentence in that document, saying, "This is my confession before I die." And he contemplates all the events of his life. The second letter that Patrick wrote is a letter called the Letter to Caroticus, or the Epistola, as it's known in Latin. It's a letter of excommunication that Patrick issues to the soldiers of a certain king called Caroticus, who was responsible for a raid on the Irish coast, during which Patrick's neophytes, or newly baptized Christians, some of them were killed and a lot of them were taken away in slavery, just like he was.
Patrick never chased the snakes out of Ireland, nor do we really know whether he used the shamrock to teach converts about the Trinity. The chronology of his life is very confused. Indeed, we can't even identify for sure when he was born, ordained a bishop, or died. The uncontested, if somewhat unspecific, biographical facts about Patrick all lie in what he tells us in his letters.
I was taken captive. I was then ignorant of the true God, and, along with thousands upon thousands of others, was taken into captivity in Ireland. This occurred according to our merits, for we had pulled back from God. We did not keep his commandments, and we did not listen to our priests, who kept on warning us regarding our salvation.
Patrick was born Patricius, somewhere in Roman Britain, to a relatively wealthy family. He was not religious as a youth, and in fact, he claims to have practically renounced the faith of his family. While in his teens, however, Patrick was kidnapped in a raid and transported to Ireland, where he was enslaved to a local warlord and worked as a shepherd until he escaped 6 years later. He returned home and eventually undertook studies for the priesthood with the intention of returning to Ireland as a missionary to his former captors.
There's a wonderful dynamic. He wasn't on a personal crusade. It wasn't just about himself. There's a wonderful bond there that slowly builds up between himself and the Irish people to whom he preaches and among whom he lives. And he feels himself responsible for these people, like a good shepherd, like the pastor that he was, and that he ties and links his own salvation to those of the Irish people, and he insists constantly that is motivated out of a love for them. Which is remarkable, because Patrick had every reason never to set foot in Ireland again, and indeed to bear a grudge, to hate the Irish people because of what they had done to him.
Patrick's humility, passion and strength, says Father Swan, really shined through in his confession. For he not only decided unilaterally to do what no man in 400 years of Christian history had done before him, that is, to carry the gospel message to what was then the ends of the earth, a far cry from the plaster of Paris saint we are often presented with each St. Patrick's Day, and, according to Father Swan, an inspiration for the priests of modern Ireland, faced with growing secularism and indifference.
In the overall landscape of the Patrick story that we have inherited in our tradition, that for centuries, maybe the image of Patrick that we had in our minds was a very powerful figure, a miracle worker, a very powerful bishop who drove the snakes out of Ireland and who was responsible for the Christianization of Ireland. But all of that story has come from his later legend and cult. When we pick up the two letters that he himself has wrote, the image of Patrick that emerges from those letters is a Christian and a man as a human being who struggles, who suffers, who raises questions about his own identity, who raises questions about his own origins, about his own vocation in life, about his own destiny. Here is a human being that is in many ways like ourselves. And in terms of our challenge today, it's a tall order, but it's not impossible. And what gives me great hope as a young priest is that words that Pope Benedict once said, that I'm not sure if he said this as Pope or Cardinal Ratzinger, that he said that Christianity outstrips postmodernity. And I thought that was a wonderful phrase, because sometimes we think of it the other way around. That kind of, we live in a post-Christian world, especially in Europe, that kind of Christianity, we've grown out of it or grown beyond it. We don't need it anymore. We don't need God. We have ourselves, and it's within our own capacity to address the problems and the situations of the world. But Patrick reminds us that Christianity surpasses post-modernity, in that I believe firmly that the challenges that postmodernity and these modern times present to us, that the answer to those challenges are found in the gospel, are found in the Christian message and in the message of faith. And that's the hope that we must always hold on to and always look to Christ for him as the answer. We need to go back to those letters, to go back to the story of Patrick, and to be inspired by what we find there. And when we do so, I believe that in this postmodern world and the challenges that face the church and every Christian, that we can be inspired in a very fresh and vigorous way by Patrick's story.
Let us go to the church at Vigo, and as the tide rises, we will gaze upon the ocean.
By the time he wrote the confession and the letter to Caroticus, Patrick was recognised by both Irish natives and the church hierarchy as the Bishop of Ireland. And so it was that a young Briton named Patricius died an Irishman named Patrick. And neither Ireland nor Christianity was ever quite the same.
So may it never happen to me that my God should separate me from his people, which he has acquired in the outermost parts of the earth. I pray that God may give me the perseverance and deign to grant that I should render him faithful witness until the moment of my passing from this life to the life to come, all for the sake of my God.
Warm thanks there to Emma McCarthy for enlightening us on the figure of St. Patrick, and of course to her guest, Father Billy Swan. Meanwhile, it's time for our weekly rendezvous with our popular Latin lover. He's Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, who I try my utmost to engage in a conversation regarding our present Pope, the previous pope to take the name Benedict, and an encyclical focusing on that great Italian poet, Dante. OK, I'd like to start deep in hell.
What is this now?
I'd like to start deep in hell and end in high heaven. Dante, the great poet.
Oh, my.
Deep in hell and high in heaven.
What are you going to... But what follows?
I want you to just to translate.
Deep in hell. Well, who's deep in hell? We deep in hell and high in heaven. We, they, you, I, she, what?
The pilgrim poet. Okay. Dante, the great pilgrim poet who started deep in hell and ended high in heaven.
Ah, poeta. Immersus in inferos. In celosque sublatus. And having been raised high into heaven, the poet, having been forced down into hell, submersus in inferos. Sublatusque in celos.
Mm. Well, as we all know, he wrote 3 books, no? That's why he's gone from hell to heaven, passing in purgatory in between, no? It was a kind of hell to heaven adventure. A hell to heaven adventure?
Adventure is almost impossible to say. Eventus mirabilis inter inferos et celos.
Pope Benedict XVI likes Dante. He often quotes from Dante, which is something that I noticed. He did so in the Immaculate Conception this year on his speech. He was speaking about Mary and what Dante says about Our Lady, etc. But in particular, in January 2006, he met with the people from the Pontifical Council Cor Unum, no? The Human and Christian Development Office in the Vatican. And his speech, the whole first page of his speech on that occasion, he quotes from Dante various times. Well, he speaks about Dante. And in particular, he quotes from Paradise, obviously. He talks about the love that moves the sun and the other stars. How does one say that?
I don't know what Dante said, but anyway.
This is a quote from Dante.
You can do it, okay. Amor solem qui movet et sidera omnia. Ah.
The Pope says, light and love are one and the same. They are the primordial creative powers that move the universe.
Lux et amor idem sunt viresque quibus. What's the universe?
They are the primordial creative powers.
Bene viresque primigene. Powers by what?
Creative powers that move the universe.
Ah, you see, that I didn't get that. That move the universe. Viresque pristine quibus rerum movetur universitas. You can say that. That's all easy stuff.
And then he goes on to say, if these words in Dante's Paradiso betray the thought of Aristotle, who saw in the Eros the power that moves the world.
Oh, Lord, spare us.
Dante, nevertheless, perceives something completely new and inconceivable for the Greek philosopher. Not only that the eternal light is shown in 3 circles, which Dante addresses using those terse verses familiar to us. Quote from Dante, O everlasting light, you dwell alone in yourself. Know yourself alone, and known and knowing love and smile upon yourself.
Yeah, that's enough of that.
Okay. The Pope also says that the vision of Dante reveals, on the one hand, the continuity between Christian faith in God and the search developed by reason and the world of religions. At any rate, he admits to the fact that this understanding of love in Dante led him to choose love as the theme of his first encyclical, no? He says,
I didn't know that.
he says, I want you to try to express for our time and our existence some of what Dante boldly summed up in his vision. He tells of a sight that was altering as he gazed on it and was being changed, interiorly changed. It didn't say that in English, interiorly changed. At any rate, what I'm trying to get at is that Pope Benedict has a huge interest in Dante. So I just wondered why this was. So one of the people who inspired him to take the name Benedict was Benedict XV. So I went along and did a little bit of research, and I discovered that on the sixth centenary of Dante's death, it was 1921, Pope Benedict XV wrote an encyclical called In Preclara Sumorum, which means what, In Preclara
Sumorum? Well, its first words don't mean anything. In the excellent, I don't know what follows, seat of the greatest people. I don't know what follows, but see, the first two words mean nothing. In Preclara Sumorum, in the outstanding of the greatest people. Oof, whatever that means. Outstanding what? I don't know.
Oh, let's see. I have it here.
Oh, I have to look into that. I have to look into these things. Now that you're... You can't do everything. Dante.
He calls Dante the most eloquent singer of the Christian idea. Among the many celebrated genius of whom the Catholic faith can boast, who have left undying fruits in literature and art especially, besides other fields of learning, not only in art and literature, in other words, and to whom civilization and religion are ever in debt, higher stands the name of Dante Alighieri. That's a pretty strong statement, isn't it?
Yeah.
1921, he's speaking to professors. He addresses this encyclical to professors and students of literature and learning in the Catholic world. Then he calls him a divine poet. How would you say divine poet in Latin?
Vate divinus.
Divine.
Or vates divinus, depends how I say it.
And he says that he's an example to us as Catholics. But you know something that I discovered? He says in this encyclical, this is Pope Benedict XV, that he was basically a disciple, Dante, of one of your chums.
Thomas Aquinas.
That's right. You guessed.
Everyone knows that. I mean, the dogs out in the street know that one.
How do you say dogs on the street know that?
Canis triviales.
He says, Dante lived in an age which inherited the most glorious fruits of philosophical and theological teaching and thought and handed them on to succeeding ages. And this is what I'd like you to translate. With the imprint of the strict scholastic method. How does one say that?
Cum rationis scholastice vestigio firmo.
Firmo is strict.
Yeah, strict.
Amid the various currents of thought diffused then, too, among learned men, Dante ranged himself as a disciple of that prince of the school so distinguished for angelic temper of intellect.
Oh, there you go.
St. Thomas Aquinas. So how do you say, Dante ranged himself as disciple of that prince
ranged.
Of the school? Ranged himself. In other words, he...
Say, collocavit.
Yes, collocavit. As a disciple, I'm not sure that these translations are very good.
No.
Dante placed himself... Perhaps.
Pause would say, discipulum.
As disciple of that prince of the school.
Principis scholarum.
So distinguished for angelic temper of intellect.
Angelico intellectus. Now you wouldn't say, my angelico intellectus ingenio.
From whom he gained nearly all his philosophical and theological knowledge.
Quo ferre omnem suam derivavit cognitionem theologicam et philosophicam. Let's face it.
We're speaking about Dante here, no? While he did not neglect any branch of human learning, at the same time he drank deeply at the founts of sacred scripture and the fathers.
That's St. Thomas. I don't think it's Dante. I don't know what he's talking about here.
No, he's talking about Dante.
Penitus hauset ex sanctorum patrum et scripturarum fonte.
Because he's speaking about Dante, you know.
Because St. Thomas does the same.
Mm.
In every other sentence, he's always quoting someone.
Pope Benedict XV also speaks about Dante using symbolic images and recording the lives of the mortals on earth. No?
Mm. I don't know.
But his true aim was the glorification of the justice and providence of God, who rules the world through time and all eternity, and punishes and rewards the actions of individuals and human society. And at this point, he mentions the fact that Dante inveighs with terrible bitterness against the supreme pontiffs of his time. Mm. This is in the encyclical. He inveighs with terrible bitterness against the supreme pontiffs of his time. How do you say that?
In pontifices maximo sui temporis vehementissime inveitur.
And get this, he adds, true, but it was against those who differed from him in politics.
Oh, my Lord. Go on.
No, how do you say that? True, but it was against those who differed
Verum
from him.
Verum said, in eos qui a se, aveo rebus in politices dissentiebant.
And he fought, were on the side of those who had driven him from his country.
From Florence.
Yeah. And he fought, were on the side of those who had driven him from his country.
Cogitabant esse ex parte eorum, qui a patria ipsum expulerunt.
Intellectual enjoyment.
That's about
that?
It.
Okay, Dante. Now, one last thing. I think this connection between the two Benedicts, our present Pope and our past Benedict, the 15th, is interesting. The fact.
Well, yeah, if they're both enamored of Dante. I didn't know either one was interested.
At any rate, then I picked out something for you from Purgatory, in Dante's Purgatory. Come and behold thy Rome, that is lamenting, widowed, alone, and day and night exclaims, my Caesar, why hast thou forsaken me?
oh my, really?
Yeah. Can you translate that?
Caesar, cur me de reliquisti. This is from scripture.
Come and behold thy Rome.
Thy Rome? Veni et respice Romam tuam.
That is lamenting. Widowed, alone, and day and night exclaims.
His lamenting.
That come and behold, thy Rome that is lamenting.
Ah,
widowed, alone.
Respice Romam tuam lamentantem.
My Caesar, why hast thou forsaken?
Caesare mi cur Romam tuam dereliquisti.
A huge thank you there to our popular Latin lover. He's Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, and he's currently working in the Vatican as the Pope's own Latinist. And that brings us up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. Thanks for listening. I'm Veronica Scaresbury.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.